Hello, and welcome to the podcast, An Intelligent Look at Terrorism. I'm your host, Phil Gursky, President and CEO of Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting in Ottawa, Canada, and this podcast is being recorded on the 15th of March, 2020, right in the midst of the COVID-19 crisis, but I'm still very, very pleased to have on the line with me, all the way from Norway, Thomas Hegghammer, somebody I've known for quite some time. And Thomas is a senior research fellow at the Norwegian Defense Research Establishment, the FFI, as well as an adjunct professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Oslo. I have to say that Thomas is one of the best scholars I've met over the years when it comes to Islamist extremism in particular, and he in fact has written several books on jihad in Saudi Arabia back in 2010 and jihadi culture in 2017, both put out by the Cambridge University Press. And one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to Thomas is that his new book is out, also published by Cambridge, The Caravan, Abdullah Azzam, and the Rise of Global Jihad. So Thomas, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Phil, for having me on.
Well, it's a real pleasure for me. So let's get right into this. You know, when I worked as a terrorism analyst for the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, I certainly was aware of Abdullah Azzam and some of his primary works like Join the Caravan and In Defense of the Muslim Lands. But I would imagine that most people couldn't spell Abdullah Azzam, let alone know about him. Why do you think it is that he's not as famous as other jihadi ideologues such as Syed Qutb and people like that?
Well, the main reason I think is that simply that he died long before this topic became kind of widely known. So he died in 1989, long before 9/11. So you kind of needed to be specialist or kind of particularly interested in this phenomenon to know about him. And there has been no biography written about him, unlike, for example, Syed Qutb. So he's not really become very well known in the Western world. But if you move to the Muslim world, he's much more widely known. Not by everybody, but really almost a household name for his role in the Afghan war in the 1980s in particular, but also as just a very prominent figure in the Muslim Brotherhood at the time.
So in other words, one of the reasons why he's not as famous is the fact that all of his works are in Arabic, and you're an Arabic linguist, as I used to be many years ago. My Arabic is woefully rusty these days, but in many ways it's a language barrier that he's not as well known as Qutb. And you mentioned in your book as well that not only is there much more written on Qutb, there are books written about Qutb and about his works. It's almost like compendiums of what Qutb wrote, Qutb being the sort of, you know, Egyptian, I won't use the word equivalent, but the Egyptian Islamist extremist ideologue in the 1950s and 60s. So I'm assuming then that the reason why you wrote this book was to make Abdullah Azzam a much more known figure in sort of the Western part of the world.
That's right. And as you said earlier, once you dip your toe into this topic of kind of radical Islamism, you will realize very quickly that Azzam is a central figure and that he's a foundational figure, and in some ways more important than Syed Qutb, I would argue. I mean, some people know him as perhaps the mentor of Osama bin Laden or as kind of the leader of the Afghan Arabs. But what's so astonishing about him is that he's not only that, he's remained widely read to this day. And just in the past sort of 5-6 years, there are tens of examples of cases of people who have either traveled to Syria or perpetrated attacks in the West, where we know that those individuals they had read Azzam. We know that specifically because that's mentioned in the cases or in the reporting about them. So he's wielded a tremendous influence on this movement, and we have lacked a comprehensive investigation into his life. And a lot of questions have remained unanswered, and there are all these kind of myths surrounding him. About, of course, first of all, who killed him in 1989. That's a big sort of murder mystery. But also other things, just kind of, you know, where did he come from? Who influenced him? And why did he end up in Afghanistan, given that he was a Palestinian? What was his relationship with Al-Qaeda? Was he really one of the founders of Al-Qaeda, as some people have suggested? There are all these questions that, you know, people have kind of debated back and forth over the years, and I've tried to kind of settle some of them.
Well, the book is very comprehensive. It's over 500 pages, and I have just begun to dip my toe into it as well. Like I said, my exposure to Azam was just reading some of his shorter works, like Join the Caravan and In Defense of the Muslim Lands. So in the research and the scholarship you did on Abdallah Azam Thomas, what did you learn about the man in a sense of his place in this, you know, this hierarchy? You mentioned that for many people, he's much more important than Said Qutb, who's a much more well-known figure. So at the end of the day, when you did all your research, you wrote the book, you know, sort of what would you say were the lessons that you learned about just who this man was and how important he actually became?
I think the main thing that I learned about him regarding his sort of influence was not really that he was sort of an Al-Qaeda man, or that he had, you know, particularly radical prescriptions for fighting or anything like that. It was something deeper, more fundamental, which didn't kind of really dawn on me until at the end of the project, after about 10 years of work, which is this: he opened Pandora's bottle in that he basically undermined religious authority in questions of jihad. One of his most famous kind of contributions was to say that, you know, if a Muslim territory is under attack anywhere in the world, then all Muslims everywhere have to go there and fight to defend that territory.
That's the issue of Fard Ain versus Fard Kifaya. So an individual obligation as opposed to a collective obligation.
That's right. And what he said was that, you know, the rules are very simple. You know, if a territory is under attack, you simply have to go there regardless of what anyone else says. And he kind of suggests that, you know, people are going to try and dissuade you from this, because there are these, because sort of the much of the Muslim community has become passive or pacifist or weak. And all these people are going to try and stop you and dissuade you from doing this, but you should not listen to them. You should just go because the religious texts are clear. And when he says this, people listen to him because he was a very highly educated religious scholar. When he says this, he is effectively telling people not to listen to other religious authorities, not to listen to their local imams, not to listen to the government, not to listen to the kind of the establishment scholars in the country they live in, not to listen to their parents, not to listen to anybody. Just pack your bags and go. Now, the problem with that is that once you've told someone not to listen to anybody, it's only a matter of time before they stop listening to you and stop listening to any authority. And that's what happened with the jihadi movement.
So what was the initial response to those who were aware of what Azam was saying, ignoring the traditional Islamic scholars, those that devoted their lives to it? Was there a pushback or an attempt to undermine, saying, hey, this Abdallah Azam guy, he's just some Palestinian, he's not sure what he's talking about, we're the real authorities, for example, in Saudi Arabia? Was there any kind of concerted effort by them to sort of undermine what Azam was saying or not?
Yes and no. I mean, first of all, we have to kind of step into the time machine and travel back to this era, which had a very different atmosphere when it comes to questions of jihad and, you know, militant Islamism. It was a time when everybody in the Muslim world, pretty much, and much of the Western world, supported the Afghan jihad against the Soviets. Mm-hmm. Just a general acceptance in the Muslim world for, you know, sort of, you know, violent resistance in, you know, these kind of, for these national liberation struggles in Palestine and elsewhere was very strong. And there were very few voices that disagreed with the fact that there was a legitimate jihad taking place in Afghanistan. So that, you know, nobody really argued with that. And so the question was really more in the specifics about what you should do about it. And so, you know, the question is, you know, is it enough to just kind of support it in your prayers? support it politically, send money or something, or to go there and fight or something else. And so this is, you have this, you know, once you've agreed that this is a legitimate conflict that, you know, people should be supporting, you then have a debate about, you have a menu of actions to be taken. And so, and that's where people disagreed. And Azzam, of course, represented the kind of the radical end of that spectrum, the kind of the bottom of the menu, the kind of the most expensive wine on the wine list, which was to say that everybody had to go there and fight. And that was not a mainstream opinion at the time. I mean, that should be clear. I mean, and we can simply tell from the numbers of people who ended up going. I estimate the number of the so-called Arab Afghans to be, you know, in the order of 7,000 to 10,000. That's over a 10-year period. So it was a marginal phenomenon, and his was a minority opinion, but he did not have very strong support from the big clerics in the Muslim world. But at the same time, these big clerics, they very rarely kind of opposed him. They didn't enter into polemics with him. Mm. What they typically did was to remain ambiguous and vague, and to say that, for example, that yes, it's the jihad, and all Muslims should support the Afghan jihad, but then they would not specify what exactly they should do or and that sort of thing. So there were only a handful of voices that explicitly criticized Azzam. People like Safar al-Hawali in Saudi Arabia or a couple of other sort of Salafi clerics, but they were just a few people. Most people just kind of tolerated him, you know, commended him for his enthusiasm and kind of general support for the cause, without really supporting the specific stance that he held, that everyone should go and fight.
So in other words, he was the right man for the right time. He was already a respected religious scholar. There was a bit of a vacuum created. Everyone recognized that the Soviet invasion was a legitimate jihad, that Muslims were suffering, and that other Muslims should come to their aid. And because he wasn't getting a lot of pushback from the other scholars, his message was the one that dominated in the 1980s. As you point out, it's remarkable that if, you know, no more than 7,000 to 10,000 so-called Afghan Arabs, plus whatever the locals were able to defeat arguably the second most powerful army in the world by the late 1980s when the Soviets withdrew. So there's nothing that wins like success, right? If you can point to that, look what we did, a bunch of guys with Lee Enfield rifles, and let's face it, some equipment from the Americans was able to oust the Soviets. So it painted a picture of that Islam won and God's on our side, and we won this through divine intervention. So I guess that sort of, he could then build on that success to go on to, you know, what then became Al-Qaeda. Now, you did sort of say, you know, in your introduction that there is some debate whether or not, in fact, Abdullah Azzam created Al-Qaeda or was part of the creation of Al-Qaeda, which leads us to his death, which you referred to in 1989, which no one's really resolved. So was this a power struggle, you think, at the time? Did somebody determine that Azzam needed to go? Is this, you think, what happened when he was killed in a car bomb with his sons in Peshawar in 89?
Nobody knows, but I don't think so. The candidates that have, you know, the list of candidates for killed him is very long. You know, over 10 different actors have been named, and you can broadly speaking group them into three. It's, you know, either someone in the Arab Afghan community, so either, you know, some Osama bin Laden or, you know, Ayman al-Zawahiri, or it's you know, someone, or it's a state. Obviously, many have mentioned the CIA or the Mossad, but others include, you know, Pakistani intelligence or Afghan intelligence or Soviet intelligence or Jordanian intelligence. All of these states have been mentioned. And then a third group of actors, which is sort of, the, you know, someone on the Afghan Mujahideen side, someone like Hekmatyar, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, a very popular... The first category is very popular, to say that bin Laden or Azzam or Zawahiri killed him. I think that's caught on. It's not taken out of thin air. I mean, there are some sources that have, you know, speculated on it, but I think it's caught on mainly because it's a very compelling story. Mm-hmm. We like infighting, mm-hmm, and drama and intrigue and sort of friends who become enemies and whatnot. But I'm skeptical of that view for a number of reasons. One is just the sophistication of the operation. To carry out this particular operation would have been quite complicated. I mean, for one, the device was, you know, reasonably complicated. You needed, basically it was a bomb placed under a small bridge over which there was traffic, and it went off right when Azam drove over it. So you would have, you know, needed to have a team of people on the ground with eyes on the target to make sure that it detonates under just his car and not any of the other cars.
So line of sight, so they could determine it and try not to take other innocent people at the time.
Right, and there were lots of people on site at the time, and you know, and you would have needed to you know, rig this a while before. So you would have needed to have a team of people that would be able to set this up without being detected by Pakistani police, and also and then executed. And then extract all of this without Pakistani authorities noticing. So that's one thing. This requires some degree of sophistication. And of course, now it wouldn't be that would be easy to do for most established jihadi groups. But at the time, these groups they didn't have that much experience in urban operations like that. They were used to fighting in the mountains, mountains and valleys of Afghanistan, to the degree that they fought at all. So neither bin Laden nor the Zawahiri had, I would argue, that much experience in that type of operation. So that's one. Another factor is, if you just wanted him out of the way, then why do it in such a spectacular fashion? You could easily liquidate Azam in another way, for example, in a drive-by shooting or something. Both Zawahiri and bin Laden knew where Azam lived, and they knew, they could easily find out, whenever he was traveling from Peshawar to one of the camps. This could have been done much more quietly. I don't see why an Arab enemy would have wanted to blow him up, at midday, right before Friday prayer, in front of all the Arabs in Peshawar. I mean, I don't see why they would do that. And the third factor is there wasn't really a precedent for murder inside the Arab-Afghan community at that time. So it would have been, a very radical step. And, this was a community that's fairly tight-knit. All of the senior figures knew each other. And bear in mind, Azam, he was like a priest. He was a religious scholar and the spiritual father of the whole community. Just killing someone like that is a gigantic step. And anyone caught in the process, even though if this were to fail or something, the reputational cost, the political cost for the perpetrator would have been enormous. So I'm not persuaded by the bin Laden or the Zawahiri hypothesis. My kind of favorite candidate is Pakistani intelligence. They had obviously the capability. They had been doing lots of urban operations like this in and around Kabul. They had plenty of expertise, and of course they also were home turf. They would not have needed to worry about surveillance or anything like that. And they had a motivation, several in fact. One is that the Arabs had for a while been a nuisance in the area. They were kind of difficult to control and had, were causing problems. And Pakistani authorities had, in fact, tried to expel Azam as early as 1986. So they were not not super happy about their presence. So you could imagine, them wanting to just, send a message, create fear in the community to get people to pack up and leave. Another factor is that that Azam was at the end, in 1989, he was involved in intra-Afghan politics and trying to, get some of the big players in the Afghan Mujahideen side to become friends and work together. And that's something that the Pakistani ISI was not keen on. They had their man, Hekmat Yar, and they didn't like Masood, who was the other main guy that Azam was trying to, get to talk to Hekmat Yar again. So they had perhaps a motivation in, kind of ending that diplomatic process. So, but again, we don't know. And there's no hard evidence for any of these candidates.
Well, certainly your speculation and your rationales seem quite convincing to me. That was more of a professional job than one by the Afghan Arabs themselves. It's interesting to look back in hindsight, and if you ask the Pakistanis, was it a great idea to take out Azam in 89, given the internal politics, given their influence in Afghanistan, which of course is still very strong today. You know, I don't like Thomas to go into sort of, look at alternative histories, but what do you think would have happened in terms of Al-Qaeda and in terms of, you know, had Azam not been killed by whomever in 89? And it's one thing that you mentioned to me, that a lot of people thought that the Afghan Arabs were somehow pro-American in the 80s in Afghanistan because they were getting U.S. help. And you argue, in fact, that they were already very anti-American in the 80s, long before the Gulf War and long before 9/11. So, you know, if you're looking back now, so what did his death mean to the movement? And, you know, was it a mistake looking back in hindsight?
Right. Well, I actually address that counterfactual head on in the book. And it's very difficult to say, but I think it's important to bear in mind that in the background here is this big fight over Azam's legacy, what he represented really. And you have several camps. You have the hardcore jihadi camp, Al-Qaeda and Islamic State that say, oh, well, we're just a continuation of what Azam wanted. Azam was one of us. He would have joined us. And we're just doing what he wanted. And then there's another camp of, you know, mostly kind of former, you know, sort of Muslim Brotherhood figures who see Azam, who claim that Azam was proponent of sort of clean jihad, and that he never would have joined Al-Qaeda. It was inconceivable because he kind of always fought clean. He told other Arabs to observe the laws of war and that kind of thing. And then there's a third camp, which is not quite relevant to this discussion, which is the Palestinian camp. I mean, there are, you know, Hamas says, you know, that Azam was the man for Palestine, that he would join them. But the main concern is this question of, you know, was he an advocate of sort of clean jihad or not? I think many, especially in the Western sort of Middle East studies community, you know, would be more, you know, in favor of the clean jihad camp. To say that Azam, that the, you know, there's this big difference between foreign fighting, going off to conflict zones and waging war, and international terrorism, flying planes into buildings, etc. And I think the consensus view, I think in the specialist community, has been that Azam did represent a, you know, sort of a cleaner form of jihad, and that, you know, it's unlikely he would have joined Al-Qaeda. But I think what I'm saying in the book is that view needs attenuation, because in his time, you know, compared to his peer, Azam was actually more radical than most. And bear in mind that, you know, people say, well, Azam never advocated international terrorism or war against America and anything like that, but neither did bin Laden at the time. Mm-hmm. Nobody was on the record by 1989 with the message that Muslims should wage jihad against America. So it's kind of anachronistic to say that, you know, Azam could never have done it because he never said it at the time. So, and then there are actually, you know, some indications in Azam's writings that I think he had it in him to go down a more radical route. For example, in 1988, he is in California giving a sermon in a mosque in California. And we know this because we have the transcript of the talk. And after the sermon, he's asked by somebody in the audience, is it legitimate? Oh, by the way, bear in mind, 1988 is right after the start of the Palestinian Intifada. Mm-hmm. Okay, so he's asked, he gets the question, is it legitimate to kill Jews here in America? Because, you know, implicitly, you know, because of what's going on in Palestine. And he says, of course it's legitimate. Whether it's wise or whether it's in our interest is another question. But from a purely, you know, theological point of view, it's legitimate. And then someone else asks, well, what about killing people who give money to the Jews? So basically it means, you know, non-Jewish American funders of Israel or something like that. And he says, that's also legitimate. No question. It's probably not wise, but it's legitimate. So add to this a ton of anti-American vitriol in his speeches throughout the 80s, and especially more so at the end of the 80s, actually, suggests to me that, you know, it's certainly not impossible that he might have changed in the 1990s, that if he had lived, he might, you know, have gone down something like the Al-Qaeda route. I'm not saying that's the most likely scenario. You know, I don't have time to kind of go into all the reasons why, but I think perhaps the most likely, if I were to put money on something, I would suggest that I would guess that he would have become kind of a sort of a grand old man of jihadism, not involved in kind of clandestine terrorism planning like Al-Qaeda was. Maybe he would have stayed in Peshawar and become the sort of wise man that issued, wrote a book every year about, you know, Bosnia or Chechnya and all the rest. And that would have had quite a bit of tolerance in Al-Qaeda activities, at least up until 9/11.
Well, it's interesting, of course, that, you know, the Americans and several other countries did support the Afghan Arabs in Afghanistan in the 1980s. Because they thought it was a good thing, of course, because since the Soviets had invaded, and of course, this is still during the Cold War, albeit towards the end of the Cold War. We didn't know at the time. I know when I worked in intelligence starting in 83, the end was not necessarily in sight. And we turned around and do the same damn thing with the American invasion, you know, troops in Kuwait, the stationing of American troops in Saudi Arabia, which, of course, Bin Laden railed against. He told the Saudis, let me do it. Let me, you know, let me to protect you, not the Americans. And then, of course, the disastrous decision to invade Iraq in 2003. Do you think that in the absence of Azam's influence in Afghanistan in the 1980s, his relationship with Bin Laden, do you think we get an Al-Qaeda without Azam, without his teachings, without his presence, without his influence?
I'm not sure. I mean, we should always be careful to ascribe too much historical importance to individuals. But I'm tempted to say no, because... Not because of his ideas necessarily, but because of his kind of organizational role and just kind of bringing people there. So, you know, Bin Laden, for example, you know, he got loosely involved in the Afghan jihad on his own, you know, independently of Azam, as early 1980. He started going to Lahore to give money to the Jamaat-e-Islami. But it was Azam's influence in 1983-84 that got Bin Laden to travel to Peshawar and get involved in the military activities there. So, you know, and then it was Azam who kind of entered into this collaboration with Bin Laden to set up the famous Services Bureau, which kind of formalized and streamlined the kind of the Arab-Afghan operations there. And without Azam, you know, Bin Laden would have been a donor to the Afghan jihad, but he might not necessarily have become a fighter on the ground as he became from 84 onwards. And, you know, without Bin Laden, the counterfactual history becomes very different for as far as Al-Qaeda is concerned. And just, you know, just the sheer fact that, you know, we know, I show in my book, to what extent, I mean, how many of the Arab Afghans went because of something that Azam did, or because of a book that Azam wrote, or because of something that the Services Bureau provided in terms of logistics or information. You take him away, and you take the Services Bureau away, then the Arab Afghan community would have been much smaller, I think, perhaps just, you know, in the hundreds of people. And then the question is, you know, could you then, out of this small community of a few hundred people, have gotten something like Al-Qaeda? Conceivably. But on balance, maybe not.
I guess the bottom line is that he clearly played a very important role. What the nature of that role is really kind of immaterial. The fact remains is that we are where we are in large part because of Abdullah Azam, his work in Afghanistan, his theological underpinning, his knowledge, and to be able to inspire people. So, you know, Thomas, I think we could talk about this for hours. I tip my hat to you for writing this book. It's a fascinating book. And I encourage everybody to go out and buy it. So I want to take this time to thank you for joining me on this podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure to reconnect. Again, we're recording this in the midst of the COVID-19 virus. I want to wish all my listeners to stay safe. But thanks for taking the time in Oslo to talk to me today.
Thank you, Phil. It's been a pleasure, as always.
Just a reminder, I've been talking to Thomas Haghammer. He's the author of The Caravan, Abdullah Azam and the Rise of Global Jihad, available from Cambridge University Press. That's it for this podcast. I'd like to hear what you thought of my talk with Thomas today. You can reach me on email, borealisrisk@gmail.com. You can go to my webpage, www.borealisthreatandrisk.com. You can reach me on Facebook or on Twitter. If you're interested in subscribing to this podcast and other material, please go to the webpage, hit the subscribe button, fill in your information, you'll get all the information free of cost to your inbox on a daily basis. That includes the Today in Terrorism series, podcasts like this, as well as Quick Hits. I'll talk to you again soon. Until then, stay safe.